Welcome to The Buzz, the podcast of the Jazz Journalists Association. I'm Howard Mandel, president of the JJA, and in this episode, we're discussing the intersections and or tensions between jazz journalism and jazz education. Our guests are Paul DeBarros, veteran journalist, longtime at the Seattle Times, and an author of Shall We Play This One Together? The Life and Art of Jazz Piano Legend Marion McPartland. Monica Herzig, pianist, band leader, and educator, formerly at Indiana University, now professor of artistic research at Vienna's Jam Music Lab University, author of books on Chick Corea and David Baker, and former editor of the Jazz Education Network newsletter. And John Zwed, professor emeritus of Yale and Columbia Universities, author of biographies of Billie Holiday, Miles Davis, Sun Ra, Alan Lomax, Harry Smith, who I first met as a freelancer at the Village Voice. So welcome, folks. And what do you think about these intersections or two separate categories? Let me start with you, Paul.
Well, I think, first of all, that jazz writing, journalism, criticism is a form of education. I don't mean to be glib, but that's really where most of my positive readership reaction has come from. It's like, oh, I didn't know about that. I never thought of looking at something like this, or no, I've never heard of this musician. So I think that's the major intersection, is that whenever we're writing about jazz in a public forum, we're educating people to a an art form that most people don't know very much about.
Monica, what's your take on something like that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'm working on the intersection of a lot of this. So I'm on the artist side and very much active on the artist side. I've been involved in three book projects that I've done, and I publish a lot of articles. And my current title is Professor of Artistic Research here in Vienna. So I have to navigate the two. And the artist side, they're very critical, saying, you know, the moment you write about things, you might take some of the magic away. Plus, you take your time away from being an artist. And then my writer side or my researcher side, especially that artistic research intersection, says, well, you have to communicate about what you're doing to make it approachable, not to water it down, but to share to people what you're doing, and it gives an extra dimension. So I see the friction here, and I'm sure we'll talk much more about it.
John, do you have a sense of a different standard for like academic education in music and what passes for the press, public press?
A few weeks ago, I'd have given a different answer, but I'm trying to get, as you know, I was trying to get rid of old jazz magazines, which are drowning me. And then I decided I better read some of them before I get rid of them. I had back issues of Jazz Monthly, particularly between 56 and 72. And I was kind of astonished. This is the same period where the Jazz Review, right? This 1959-61 American one was at the same moment, right?
Yeah.
Now, I think Jazz Review is copying them, frankly, and not doing as good a job. But what shocked me was, well, two things. One was that what they call jazz included a certain amount of pop, certainly a lot of blues. Paul Oliver was always on the case in Russell was writing about blues. But they also had articles on, multi-parted article on Boogaloo or something, Latin dance of that sort, Latin music. That was the first part. And on poetry, literature, film, the range was pretty big. But the second part is the really shocking part. The writing level was really high. And one way they kept it high was that they allowed the authors to criticize each other. Now, The Voice did that when I worked there at one point, and I remember someone wrote in from the Midwest and said, you lovable schmucks, do you really believe any of us care about what you think about each other? But it wasn't like that. Occasionally it was like that, but they were dealing with race, before downbeat was. That was this kind of startling thing, and more perceptive ways, I think. My point is, I was still learning. I'm reading this stuff and seeing, I didn't know that about Parker, or I didn't know that about so-and-so. These people were really running at a high level. Now, the Jazz Review had one difference, other than maybe the size and depth, and that was that they had musicians write. And if you've read those, you know that they were really rough on each other. George Russell, for example, was really rough on the musicians. I learned much of what I know out of reading jazz magazines, and if I had read these before, I would have gotten a lot more. I think the problem now is the problem that we have, that criticism is facing in lots of fields, certainly in painting and sculpture. They say, at least not talking about the painters themselves, but by and large, nobody does bad work. Everybody does good work, or they do okay work. And jazz journalism increasingly is in that role, which is to say they're doing publicist work. Am I exaggerating?
I don't know. Let's ask Paul DeBarros about that. Is he exaggerating? Is it all positive reviewing and trying to put a good spin on it?
No, I don't think it is. In my lifetime, I've certainly been aware of a period when jazz criticism was, before I started reading jazz magazines, where jazz critics were publicists. And a lot of the early critics just grew out of their passion for the music, but also promoting stuff. And that seemed to have gone down when I really entered the scene in the 60s. And there was, a heyday of criticism when Dan Morgenstern was editing Downbeat and Leroy Jones, Amiri Baraka was writing for the magazine. And there was more, I think, right in your face negative criticism then. And I thought it was good. I think there is less now, but I certainly don't hang back from telling people if I don't like a record. And I've often, I met somebody at Jazz Ahead this year in Bremen who from Latvia. And she said, I've been reading your stuff for years. You're the only person who goes after anybody. Well, I'm not sure that's the best compliment I've ever had, but I did take it to heart.
It's true, and you should be complimented.
Okay, thank you. I think there is less negative criticism, and I think it's because of this really bad disease that has infested jazz writing in general, which is that we have to protect the art form because it's so fragile. We have to make it. We have to quote unquote support jazz. You know, if I hear one more presenter come out on the stage and thank me for supporting jazz as if it were about to fall over and only had one leg, I'm just going to throw up.
I want to know from Monica what she thinks about there's no negative criticism out there from the artist side. Do you see that? And from the teacher's side, what do you have to say about it?
Right. Well, there is some, you know, it's just become more subtle. So for example, if in Downbeat you get a 3-star review, it means a negative because you didn't get into the upper echelon. But, you know, I actually talked to Frank about it. And the thing is, compared to 50s and 60s, we have so much more coming out. I mean, it's exploded, right? So as an editor, why would you pick the lower end stuff? So now there is so many good things to pick from. So the way he explained it to me, and I totally understand that, is that if it's not good and if it's not liked, it doesn't even get a review. So meaning those who don't get any notion, that's the bad review. And those who are reviewed are actually in that category that they deserve it. So maybe that's how things have changed a bit in terms of what gets even written about.
You're speaking about Frank Alkire, the editor and publisher of Downbeat. Oh, my. Well, I write record reviews for Downbeat, and I just gave somebody 3 stars. In fact, both of my last 2 reviews have been 3-star reviews. And in the the most recent to be published, I said, this is a good record, but it's not for me. And I gave it 3 stars. And I felt very conflicted about writing this review because it was a skillful record. I didn't care for the material whatsoever. And the material was classical material. It was Bach that he was playing. And I in any case, giving a 3-star review, yes, it speaks to the skill, the production, and admits that this might be for other people more than for the reviewer. That's how I look at that.
Right.
But how do academics look at this? How do academics look at jazz journalism? Do they take into account sort of those nuances that Frank Alkire is referring to, the growth of material, you know, the flood of it, good material?
Oh, absolutely. Here's a great example. I just taught a class and I called it historiography. And what we did, instead of, you know, teaching the good old great man lineage of history of one followed after another, and here's the great tree, I said, you know, there's so much we left out, which we have, you know, and from my perspective, there's incredible things that were left out and this great man lineage doesn't work. So I said, you are going to do this in a different way. Look and find. Go on treasure hunt. And instead of me telling you this is what happened in history and then, you know, Charlie Parker followed this and followed this, find something that interests you and you're curious about and put it in the context of the time and what needs to be known about it and write it in history. And one of my students found these boxes of jazz podiums in his dad's. So these are the German journal and they were from 1960. So he pulled out one from 1960 and then looked at it and thought about it. How is this different to what we have today, right? Just from the look, the front, there's like just blue. It's very plain. These days, it's cluttered with little things because our attention span is gone. And then opening it up and it's one mark, you know, which is like 50 cents and the prices. And then looking at the ads of the clubs that are open till 4 a.m., which is, that doesn't happen anymore. And then looking at the language of how things were described, and there happened to be an article about women in jazz, and it was like, oh, very different. And then there were some reviews in it. But it was very interesting. So from the academic side, I thought it was really educational for them to look and compare and see how we change the language and how we look at things and how the culture has changed. So yes, a lot to learn.
Paul, are you conscious of having changed your practice over the decades that you've been working in the popular press? You changed your vocabulary, you changed your approach in ways that you are conscious of?
I think I've changed, but I've adapted to the media that I've been writing for. I mean, when I'm writing for a daily newspaper, a much different proposition than writing for Downbeat or an academic journal for all that. I mean, maybe that's a better question for somebody to ask about me, because I'm not aware of changing, but I certainly adapted to the environment of a daily newspaper where I realized, you know, most, it's like a fraction of the people reading this paper could care about jazz at all. Like, they don't really know what it is. And for me, I guess one thing that changed is that when I started out, I was much more of a flag waver for music that was only liked by very few people. And I think once I got older, I realized that was a fruitless attitude, that there was no reason for me to try to convince people to like Albert Eiler. I mean, either they were going to like it or they weren't. I could tell them about it, but I couldn't wave the flag and tell them that they were somehow remiss for not liking it. So, but that maybe is just more about growing old than adapting to a market.
John, let me ask you, especially about your bios. Those bios seem to me to be written for every reader, not necessarily an academic reader. Is that the case? Are they adopted by educators?
You're giving me more credit than I deserve. I don't really think about audiences. I remember reading something where somebody said, you create your own audience. And I was thinking, yeah, well, that's right, but how do you do that? I never really thought that through. And I didn't think of them as bios. I thought of them as puzzles. Sun Ra and Harry Smith are completely puzzles, but also something wrong with the Billie Holiday material. Also something wrong with Miles Davis's autobiography. I think I wasn't the only one who thought that. I wouldn't have done either of those books had I not found that somebody hadn't gone to the library. I mean, there was 800 pages about Billie Holiday written by Linda Kill, who unfortunately, you know, killed herself. And most of it wasn't useful, but what was amazing. And then I found the original of the Billie Holiday book where she'd been edited out. So those were puzzles. They weren't bios. They were same thing with Lomax. I thought Lomax had all these enemies. he had his problems, but it's not the ones they're talking about. I worked for him. I knew it. That was a different story. Anyway, the Miles book was heavily rewritten from what Miles said. So it was given to me by a puzzle. I didn't know what kind of audience would be dealing with this. So I got two reviews in 1 week, the New York Times on the Miles book, which my agent said, that means it's important, right? I said, yeah, and both reviews were bad. One said it was doing the same stuff that, you know, that everybody else was doing. And the other was saying they spent one third of it discussing whether Miles said he changed jazz 4 times or 5 times. I had corrected the author on this, but I wasn't allowed to say I was correcting anything because the lawyer said I had no right to do this because the co-writer from Davis wouldn't let me have any permission to use his stuff, which I got anyway because it was in the library. But so I realized that the reviewers were, they had a fixed picture of, how can I say this? Everyone has a bio in their head of these people we know, even if you know only a little bit. And someone comes along and shows you another view of it and said, that's not my Billie Holiday. My Billie Holiday was, you know, didn't do that or should have done that or whatever. So that's what you're confronting when you do that. And I've also been accused of not taking any positions on anything, partly because it didn't interest me. I've just found late in life that Virginia Woolf had a lot to say about bios. And what she was saying at the beginning, 1920s, was that they've all been about heroes. Now, this is what worries me, you know, the heroes and the saints and the kings and queens and so forth. And they're always wonderful. But something was starting to happen in 1925. Movies were coming in and so forth and so on. And people were beginning to become critical. And she declares that the only way biographies can survive is that they adopt the qualities that we find in fiction. Now, that's happened. And it's crap. I mean, I can name you any number of books that I know something about and know that they made up stuff. They sometimes say it is, she should have known, or she must have been at the so-and-so. Uh-huh. I'm saying that I don't really write bios, is what I'm saying. I'm writing puzzles about people and seeing if I can figure out what's going on. Now, frankly, I don't understand Harry Smith in the least. I mean, I could pretend to. Sun Ra, I got a better grasp on, but believe me, I'm far from...
Sometimes you're presenting a certain amount of material, though, and we are, you know, privy to this material that you've gathered for us, the little bit of the puzzle that you've solved. And I think that the academic people are taking that in as valid information. And I think that the journalists also are saying, well, now you've established the standard for our coverage that we have to refer to, be in reference to.
I wonder if... Henry Threadgill would be getting such positive reviews if it wasn't a full professor behind him. I'm not being negative about him. I'm being about what gets published and what gets acted on. I have to like his book, and he's, you know, I can hear his voice in there. And I also like the person who, what I'm just saying, he's shown up on some of the best book lists this year, which is just phenomenal for a musician of that sort, don't you think?
Yes, Henry Threadgill biography, yes, it's unusual to see on Vasquez. I think that the thing there is the humor in Henry's stories and the outlandishness of of what he says about himself is it comes through. I don't know, Monica. Do you think that having a full professor write a biography gives it a leg up in the marketplace? Are your books well received that way because of your status?
I don't think the author background matters that much. Everybody's just looking at who's the writing about, you know. So if I write a book about Chicoria, people could care less about me. They just get the book because they want to know about Chicoria. So, and both of them, they look even at the cover and see my name, even if I have it, and they don't realize that that's me. So, no, I don't think that has much to do with it. Maybe there's access. The thing about writing is that it's such a it's even a less profitable business than being a jazz musician. So being a professor helps, I guess, to have the backdrop of being able to afford it.
That's true.
Paul, I want to bring in one other thing that before we end up, because one of your this is another level of jazz education, of course. The bands in the high schools, which in Seattle have been very popular activity, after school activity, and those people in those bands have won competitions, nationwide competitions. And I gather that you had the inspiration to cover some of those bands in the newspaper, in your daily newspaper, as if they were sports teams. Is that the case? And that you built some readership this way.
That's what eventually happened. Yeah. I mean, I grew up playing in bands in junior high and high school, so I was really familiar with jazz education in the schools. And when I first started writing about jazz, and I just should preface this by saying that what I managed to accomplish at the Seattle Times in terms of popularizing the high school jazz bands in this town, and I did have a hand in that, it just isn't possible anymore because there's nobody writing about jazz regularly in a daily paper. So unfortunately, this is something, a phenomenon that I don't think could happen again. But what happened was that I started going out to hear some of these bands. And at first I was appalled. I said, my God, these bands are horrible. These directors clearly are classical guys who don't know anything about swing. They don't know anything about the repertoire. And somebody just told them they had to have a jazz band. And then I went out and I heard the Roosevelt and Garfield bands in Seattle. And I thought, whoa, who are these dudes? They really know what they're doing. And they were both conductors were players. One was a drummer. One was a trombone player. They knew the repertoire. And if I sat down and talked to them about stuff, they would debate with me about, you know, which was the best recording of a certain Ellington tune or a certain Basie tune. And they knew the stuff in many cases way better than I did, the big band repertoire. So I started following them. And it just made great daily newspaper copy because every parent wants to see their kid's name in the paper, especially in a town that you could still characterize as small like Seattle. So I realized, I went to talk to the sports guys. I said, wow, this works, doesn't it? He said, oh, yeah, man, put every name you can in here. And so I went to all the competitions. And then I started realizing, oh, it is like sports because these kids start getting groomed in seventh grade. So then I started listening to the junior high, middle school bands. And you look at a guy like Riley Mulherker, who just brought out his first album as a leader this week. I was writing about Riley when he was in seventh grade, pointing him out and saying, you know, I think the kid might have a future. Well, that was a good call. And so, yeah, I got not only a great readership, but Starbucks jumped in and sponsored not because of me, but just part of this momentum, sponsored a concert which sells out a 3,000-seat theater every year with five high school jazz bands. So, yeah, it became kind of a phenomenon where this town, it's proud of its coffee, it's proud of Amazon sometimes, and it's very proud of its jazz bands. And And its directors are really icons in the city.
You've been listening to The Buzz, the podcast of the Jazz Journalists Association. We've been talking about the intersections of jazz journalism and jazz education with Seattle journalist and Marion McPartland biographer Paul DeBarros, with pianist, educator, author Monica Herzig, formerly of Indiana University and now professor of artistic research at Vienna's Jam Music Lab University, and John Zwed, professor emeritus of Yale and Columbia Universities, author of biographies of Billie Holiday, Miles Davis, Sun Ra, Alan Lomax, and Harry Smith. I'm Howard Mandel, president of the Jazz Journalists Association. To learn more about us, go to jjanews.org. The Buzz drops new episodes regularly, available on all major platforms. This edition was edited by Wiz Petter, with John Michael's composition Big Vic as our theme music. Check back for more of The Buzz.